Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 146, being recorded on the 28th of September, 2016, with special guest, Rasmus Holt. I'm Street, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, Russell, and Rasmus, special guest. So we have quite a cast today, and I want to thank Rasmus for joining us and sharing his thoughts on a very interesting topic, which we'll get to in just a minute. But as our listeners know, this week is Ignite, and as is typically with Ignite, we have a bunch of updates on Azure. So let's jump right into that first. So I think Evan did a good job putting a whole bunch of updates in the show notes. But let's see, anyone you want to start with? Evan, Kale, anyone you like there?
Go ahead, Kale. I mean, the list is long.
Yeah, I think the ones that stood out for me are ones that people have been asking about. At least people I work with a lot have been asking about the DNS being generally available. I think that's been a kind of a long time coming. So that's actually GA now, the actual DNS system that's built into Azure that you can use for your external DNS queries. Probably the other one is around storage. There was a couple things, actually. The disk encryption for Windows and Linux, standard and premium virtual machines is GA, as well as, I think we talked about this last time a bit, the encryption for storage service for Azure Storage is generally available. And then I don't know which region this is, and maybe you guys know, the premium storage is generally available in some additional regions. I have to dig that up. I think North Central US is one of them, but there's a bunch of other ones that says, so I'm not 100% sure, but it's in other regions now. That's something that was new.
Yeah, I know we've been working hard to expand that, so yeah.
And that's different from this accelerated networking, right, that they put in place in public preview?
Yeah, so that's the other half of, that's the other half of a whole bunch of these, right? There's a whole bunch of networking things that got announced. There's the, I think we call it accelerated networking, which is really leveraging, and this was a really interesting article a few months back about, and I can't remember what the abbreviation stands for, FPGA, basically programmable cards, in essence, that we're using to do our networking, and that's allowing tremendous speeds, and that frees up CPU cycles at the host and guest, so that we can basically provide more of that to our customers, right, at the same hardware, which is ultimately going to, you know, translate probably to lower cost or higher CPU availability. We've got web application firewall in public preview, virtual network peering. This one I actually think is pretty cool because although I like IPsec, site-to-site is pretty cool technology. Those are fun to troubleshoot at times. It always has seemed kind of silly that you have to do, in essence, a site-to-site connection to connect two VNets in Azure, right? We can already talk VM to VM in a given VNet, but to have to do, in essence, a site-to-site connection for VNet to VNet always has been problematic. Now you can go kind of directly from one VNet to another without a gateway and a site-to-site tunnel. The last one I'll throw in is Azure DNS. So for those of you that are keeping score, it's probably top five in my knowledge of Azure services and how long they stayed in preview. It is finally released. We're going to let customers host their DNS records in Azure, right? Just like there's other third parties that allow people to do that.
So what's
it finally went GA.
Why did it take so long? Any ideas, Evan?
I don't know all the ins and outs. They've had a couple of problems over the years. You know, they had some, there was a DNS outage 7 months ago or so, and I think that this really was because DNS is such a core feature right? If DNS doesn't work, then good luck using, I mean, networking is kind of useless. If you can't look up where something lives, then, you know, the fact you can connect to it doesn't really help. I think they just wanted to be really, really sure that what they put out was truly robust enough and stable enough to be able to say, hey, we're going to support this at scale, you know, at like it's a production service.
That's really saying a lot for the team, right? They really want to make sure things are good before they put it out there. They don't want to rush something out just because, you know, the competitor may have it and they want to get it out there.
Absolutely.
It's got to be just right. Yep.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wanted to call it out, right? I mean, that team, I mean, it's a core feature, core infrastructure feature. You know, everything's heavily dependent on it, and if they messed it up in a production sense, right, we have production sites, production deployments that are going to be not work or not be accessible, at least not by DNS name. So I think they just want to be really sure they did it, and they were willing to take the, to your point, the marketing hit, in essence, to make sure that this was, you know, as solid as it needed to be to meet the need.
Yep. Hey, Russell, anything you like on the list there?
Well, there was a whole host of networking improvements. So, I mean, we've talked about the DNS one and accelerated networking, and that accelerated networking goes up to 25 gigabits per second, apparently, and reduces latency by up to 10 times, which is quite good. But generally, across the board, they've announced that the whole global networking is going to be improved. So just with a VM that you've got at the moment, that's going to get improved bandwidth of up to, I think it's between 33 and 50%. So that's being rolled out across the board by the end of 2016. There's a whole blog post on all the different networking bits that have gone on there. So IPv6 is in there. So that's having native support and network connectivity from your Azure VMs. Active VPN gateways, so higher availability and resilience on those as well. Some improved diagnostics. It's a whole... batch of stuff all together with in the networking stuff. But yeah, the DNS one was the one that I was looking for as well. So I'm pleased that's there.
well, the IPv6 one is kind of important from an IoT perspective, right? Because with the growth of IoT, we have so many addressable machines now in the world. The V4 address space just doesn't cut it in some cases. And I think that's a critical upgrade to support the IoT workload.
Yeah. It's been used internally, I think, by a lot of things like Office 365 for some years now. So this is the first time it's been offered out to Azure customers as well. So that's good.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering if you read about the H series VMs as well.
Oh
the high performance compute ones. Yeah.
What's special about them?
So they're going up to 16 cores and 224 gig of RAM. So they're all about high performance compute. And I think they've got 2 terabytes of SSDs on them and 8 NICs. So very low latency.
Wow.
Lots of high compute
stuff.
2 terabyte
SSDs. I wish I could have one of those in my machine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm gonna go on record, and luckily I don't know anybody in marketing, but is anybody else having a hard time keeping up with the letters? I've now lost total. Every time someone asks, "Well, what's this series? Is it A?" Okay, I remember what those are. Everything else past that, I'm really having a hard time keeping up.
Well,
I mean, I know you can see what we're doing, but it's hard.
But
to
it seems like the letters are somewhat related to the, I guess, like H for high performance. Right? I think they're trying to at least line them up in a meaningful way, but they're going to run out of letters real soon, I think.
Absolutely, that's what I mean. And even now, I mean, I think there's a little bit of it. Well, is that an A2 or an A2, what,
A2V2,
yeah.
I feel sorry for the people sitting the accreditation exams now, because there are quite a lot of the questions early on were based around the. So, yeah, it's going to be difficult.
Absolutely.
I think, if you go for the exam, you're going to need a cheat sheet in there for sure on that. So I certainly like the, I'm a big Service Fabric fan, and we talked about the release of Service Fabric for Linux in the last episode. That was for download, for customers to download themselves, and this week they're following up with the Azure release, or the preview of Service Fabric for Linux in Azure. So that's in public preview, as well as the Azure Service Fabric for Windows Server now, which was in GA in preview, is now generally available. So, a lot of movement on the Service Fabric front, both in the Windows and in the Linux area. So that's good news for Service Fabric France. All right, so do we cover all the news? I'm just trying to look through the list here. It looks like we got everything, right?
There was some
security
the web updates, I
application
think. So,
gateway. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the app gateway and the security center have been upgraded. So there's a few new capabilities around vulnerability assessments, storage assessments, and some new WAF capabilities been built in. So if you've got an application firewall there, if you want to make use of that, it's got a lot more capability in it now.
Yeah, this web application firewall, it's kind of an easy thing for our customers to use, right? Just you put it up there and it picks up like about 10 common vulnerabilities. It will monitor for those for people trying to kind of hack your website and block it. And you can put it in two modes. You can put it in a detect only mode, or you can actually do active protection. In other words, detect and take action, like blocking a particular request and things like that. So I think it's that's something that I know I'm going to try and enable for some of my own websites, because it's just a common sense thing to do.
And I think one of the nice things about the way they've implemented it in Azure as well is that you can integrate with third-party tools and partner tools as well. So it's not just taking the stuff off the box. You can also use other providers if you've got those as well.
Okay. All right, Cale, Evan, anything else you want to touch on before we move on to Rasmus?
No, I think we hit that. My favorite.
I think it's good. We need to probably circle back with each one of these in a full episode, but that's cool for now.
I agree. We do it like an Ignite episode or something like that. All right, so our special guest today is Rasmus Holt, and he comes to us from the Netherlands. Really, it's late in the evening there, and I appreciate him taking the time to talk to us about a topic that he's, I guess, very familiar with and he's passionate about. So, Rasmus, why don't you start by giving us a quick background about yourself and what you do at Microsoft?
All right. Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. A little correction. I visit the Netherlands a lot, but I am from Copenhagen, Denmark. So,
my bad.
no worries. Proud to be a Dane, the happiest country in the world. And it might be the Legos. I don't know. But we really enjoy our choice here. So,
yeah,
it might be that could be also be a reason. Yeah. Right about that. So when I don't play with Legos or having a beer, I work for Microsoft as a technical evangelist. And I work in like a ninja team that ensures that we have a great story around topics like automation and DevOps, and just making sure that things are available for all our IT pros and devs to go ahead and build on our platforms, especially our cloud platform, and making sure that automation is thought into our products. So that's what I do every day. I work with the product teams, customers, and I am also at conferences, at meetups, sharing the great stories that we have.
And, did you say you were part of a ninja team? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Wow. How come I'm not aware of this ninja team?
How could you be aware of a ninja team?
Oh, yeah, it's supposed to be. That's right. What am I talking about? So this is
point.
Cool. So give us some examples of, you know, what kind of discussions you have with customers in this area, in the DevOps and things like that.
Yeah, so DevOps is a motion in the market. It's a way of thinking how we work with IT, and we try to boil it down to make it more binary. So we talk about practices, and one of these practices inside the whole DevOps world is infrastructure as code. And infrastructure as code, it is born out of automation. Some could even go that far to call it common logic. But we like to call it infrastructure as code, and taking the whole notion of automating how you work with your infrastructure to the next level. So that is one of the conversations that I'm having on different levels, right? I will go to customers and apply infrastructure as code, and I will be at your show talking about it and sharing some of the learnings we have from actual implementations. So automation, to put it very low key, is a big thing for me. And it's funny, it also connects to some of the releases from Ignite here. And I listened in while you were going over them. And the DNS part, for one, is just an awesome part for the automation team. Because it means, yeah, we have this great service in Azure that serves DNS queries for public addresses. But for most people, that's just a commodity, the service itself. But just being able to automate your DNS records and changes with the power of PowerShell and Azure Resource Manager, no one else has that but us. So sorry for bragging, but that's the reality. And that is really a strength.
That's very good. So let's dive a little bit deeper into that. I mean, it's very interesting the way you explained it, infrastructure as code. How did this come about? Why is that important? Treating infrastructure as code.
All right. So a little bit of background, maybe. So the first time that discussion around this started was actually back in 2009. At a Velocity conference, and this is where we saw actually the first discussions around this this topic. So back then it was called Agile Infrastructure. Actually, I think that was the name of the session at the Velocity conference. Agile Infrastructure, just the screaming need from developers to have some kind of self-service automated way to address their infrastructure needs. So as development cycles speed up in companies, waiting for a de-attached team, like a operations teams in some organizations are, was really frustrating for these people. And they opened up the topic and talked about this agile infrastructure. To be honest, agile infrastructure can mean anything. but what it really meant was to start sharing goals between operations people and developer. And that goal should be to deliver changes to the environment faster. And the only way we can accelerate these development goals is by automating, and automating everything, or at least as much as possible. So that was the early part. What we since then have done to define this and refine it is actually to look at an old practice called software development. So in infrastructure, we have built infrastructure for years, for decades. But we have done it in a specific way where we have refined our infrastructure, and we have done it in a artistic way, right? And really nursing our infrastructure, treating it like a pet, I like to say. And where when we move to a cloud world or this agile world, we might not be able to go and treat our infrastructure like a pet, calling the doctor every time it's sick, right? Nursing it, petting it, making sure that it feels good. No, we need to move to this cattle notion, and you probably heard this before, treat your infrastructure like cattle, not like pet, where we simply just take away the broken parts and redeploy them. And the way we could do this was by looking at our developer friends and learning how they build software, right? Taking experience from the best developers out there and start treating our infrastructure like a software development project. And there are some very basic and disciplines to implement here, and they might not be new to people. And I can walk you through them. There's five easy steps that we can discuss.
Wait a minute, this sounds like some sort of intervention if we've got five easy steps here.
Sorry. Well, it could be, right? But just wait, you're going to nod your head when I take you through the five steps. You're going to say, I knew this. I'm doing this already. But infrastructure as code is treating your infrastructure like a software development project. By the way, if you look up infrastructure as code in Wikipedia, it's going to tell you a very simple notion that it must be infrastructure defined in a script or a machine processable file. And that is also true, but I'd like to take it a step further and taking some disciplines from software development. So a first one would be start putting everything in code, right? Make scripts, make templates. It doesn't really matter how you talk to your infrastructure. Just please keep away from the user interface and start using these automation engine. And they exist on Linux, they exist on Windows, they exist on Hyper-V, VMware, whatever infrastructure you're using. Just start scripting it, start putting in a template, and if you can use the interface to experiment, to learn new things, but when you're building production environments, you should try to stay away from user interfaces because they are not self-documenting, they are not reproducible, the steps you do there. In code, in scripts, you have all these benefits.
Let me just throw one other benefit in too, and I'll let you go on, but because I'm hearing you talk about this and trying to think about when somebody just tries to tell me what the problem is and how they configure their environment, your concept of scripts really, really would make that easier at that point, because it's clear as day in the code.
Mm. Yeah, and this notion of being self-documenting is really appealing to IT professionals.
Yeah.
I mean, just not having to write the documentation because it's in code already, it's a burden come off our shoulders because we never got that documentation written, or we only have time to write it when we forgot half of it, which is very common scenarios. The next thing is to put it in source control. So if you have developers in-house, you probably have a source control, right? But source control, they are like, they keep versions of what we do. They do an audit trail for us. So we know who did what changes, not to have the blame game, but just to make sure that we have this self-documenting notion when we work with our infrastructure. And source control also has the benefit of we are storing our configuration together with the application that we are serving. So that is very easy. And there's a lot of great source controls out there. GitHub can be free, but then it's public. I like to use Visual Studio Team Services, which is free up to 5 users and has a great Git-based source control. It's just great tools to get started with, and I encourage everyone to investigate those if you're not using them already. Step 3 is build your stuff for automated deployment and continuous deployment. So if you're working with on-premises infrastructure, just building automation is of course there. You have it in code. Just make sure that you have what I like to call a build server, automation server, that can automatically deploy that code. Don't run the scripts from your own machine. Have a build server that does that for you. And also build this for continuous deployment. So it's also going to be your backup plan. So if you have a piece of infrastructure and it breaks down, you can just go and redeploy it, right? Back to the cats and pedal, or pets and cattle, sorry. And just build it for continuous deployment. That way you will have you could call it a code standby of your application, but you would have a backup plan if your primary application or running application breaks down. And it comes cheap if you did source control and if you put it in code.
Erasmus, just to clarify one thing, when you say put it in a build server, what? And you said don't run it from your own machine. What is there any particular reason why you wouldn't want to run it from your own machine, or just so that everybody can share the same build script, and that's why you put it on a build server?
Great question. Thank you. So, so what we want to make sure is that when we run our code and our scripts, that it runs the same exact way each time we run it, and that we can run it from a new location, and it would run the same way each time we run it. So if we run it from my machine, I don't know about you guys, but I have all kinds of SDKs and script supports and stuff installed on my computer. And a script might work on my computer, but if I'm to hand it off to Russell or Ivan, it might run in a different way, give a different result. So just having a central automation server that runs our script for us will make sure that it runs the same way each time. And by the way, have the configuration of that server also automated so you can rebuild it if that breaks down. And that is just, it's just the right way of doing it. It makes a lot of sense, right? Because you don't have those personal dependencies.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And this could be like a Jenkins server as well, right, for automation?
Jenkins is great for automation. They have these automation servers. And now you're starting to add tooling on top of it. So Jenkins, again, Visual Studio Team Services. We have Octopus deployed. There's a lot of tools out there. But what they do is they let you have these build agent servers that you can send commands, and then the build servers, they execute the commands. So automation servers, to put it in a different word. The cool thing about Jenkins and Visual Studio Team Services is that they have like these steps that you can add. So you can have sequential steps, like first provision my infrastructure, deploy the code, do some testing, add monitoring, etc. So they help you build these automation workflows, which is, again, a benefit if you did all above. So yes, absolutely great tools, and I encourage everyone to look at them, especially if you're looking into continuous deployment. So the next thing, and this is always a delicate topic. So number four is testing. So how do you guys feel about testing your work?
It keeps me in business that most people don't. I'm just going to be upfront about that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm a developer. I never test my stuff.
You never test it.
I hate testing. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I think
I have unit testing, but I don't know about beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah, for me with the DevOps stuff nowadays, a lot of what people miss is that the testing of the environments once they're live. So getting the build working, get built, that's normally okay. We've done it. Now we're going to deploy our code to it, and it's the bit afterwards that they forget to do. So performance monitoring, load testing, all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Yeah, exactly right. But I mean, just testing what you just deployed, wouldn't that be just a basic thing to do?
Would be ideal.
Again,
yeah,
we can learn a lot from developers. I mean,
you mean like a smoke test, right, of your deployment? Is that what you're talking about here?
Yeah. You can do many types of tests. So let's just run through them basically. So the first one is linting. Linting is a way of validating your deployment scripts. So if you write it in PowerShell, there's tools out there that can validate your PowerShell scripts prior to executing them. Just remember, the PowerShell script can take 30 minutes, 1 hour to execute if it's an advanced piece of infrastructure. And you don't want to waste that hour. You can do other stuff, I know that. But you don't want to be set back that hour in deployment for something you could have tested automatically. So we don't want to do manual tests. Manual test is manual work, and we hate manual work. We hate work in general, but this is easy to automate. So just applying some of these linting tests for PowerShell scripts. In Azure, if you're using Azure, linting is part of the Azure Resource Manager stack, so you can't work without it.
So that's just validating the template is correctly formed?
Yes. Just making sure that prior to executing it, that it is valid.
But that won't go as far as validating that one of your parameters has got a unique name, for example, or something like that.
That could be one. Did you put in bad parameters, wrong machine sizes? We talked about the naming of virtual machines earlier. Did you actually go and invent a new machine? Stuff like that is being tested prior to executing.
Okay.
So that's one thing. That's the linting part. The next part is testing, or unit testing. And that is just right, after deployment, test that your VMs has the right names, right? That's an easy PowerShell query, and throw an error if they don't. Test that you have the right number of machines. That's also very easy. And taking it to the extent of integration test, also a developer practice. Just testing that you're getting the response that you should. Maybe you can make test that you can make a SQL query from your front-end server to your back-end server. It's easy things to automate, but they will, if you have a misconfiguration of your infrastructure, they will save you a lot of time by telling you right away that something is not as they should be. And I will encourage anyone, if you did step one, two, and three, testing is your next one. Just adding that would, just starting to add it slowly will help you have more solid, more on-time deployments. And bridging into number five, which is probably for most a no-brainer, Russell, you mentioned it, is the feedback loop. It's just the constant monitoring. So once our infrastructure is deployed, that we start to monitor what's going on. And for many, especially larger organizations, monitoring is a different team. So it's something we apply later on. But I will encourage everyone to have that as part of your deployment, just adding the monitoring agent, setting up a rule set. All those things should be able to be put in PowerShell or some kind of CLI, and just that configuration applied as soon as the machine is deployed. And I call that the feedback loop, just getting that monitoring up and running as part of your deployment. So that's five easy steps. Sort control, put it in code, automate your deployments using a build server, testing and feedback.
Yeah, testing is really, that's step four. I like that step four. I've not really ever considered going and validating with automation test that an environment template had been built correctly. I've always just gone into the portal and sort of looked at it and seen has it done what I wanted it to do. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we think about it for code and we take it for granted. A lot of people miss doing it in things like JavaScript when we start moving to client-side development, but now that's become normal to do that. So, yeah, why not with infrastructure as well? That's a good point.
I think that's one of the whole reasons that ARM, you know, resource manager stuff kind of came about, right? Because this code as or infrastructure as code was, if you templatize it, I mean, because if you templatize it now, it's not only is it much, much simpler code, but it is very easy to source code control at that point.
Mm. Yeah, and some would say it's easier to read and template versus a command line script.
Oh, so absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that 100%.
So we call this declarative approach. So it declares a desired state. We also have it in PowerShell DSC, or desired state configuration, where we in a file, you could argue this, but it is readable, humanly readable. You just might need to get used to it, but fairly quickly you will be able to decipher a ARM template. I hope you agree. But this declarative approach tells our automation engine what to do. So I want five machines, I want this DNS configuration, I want this network. Whereas in a traditional scripting manner, we have this imperative approach where we actually put in commands. So how? We tell the machine how to do it. So we define one command at a time, right? So please go and make a virtual machine with this configuration parameters, then set up a DNS record. So this is imperative. We just put it in commands. And there's nothing wrong with one over the other than I would say it's easier to read a declarative template, a desired state template.
Well, I think the other big drawback of the imperative way of doing it is if you've got a really large script and it fails halfway through, then to recover from that is quite often quite a nasty job.
Yeah.
I mean, ARM makes that a lot easier with the resource groups and the way you can manage that, but the way in which the template deploys is far simpler, I think. So you just fix the problem that you have and you redeploy, and it goes off and fixes that particular issue.
Yeah,
just that part, right? Not kind of kill everything and recreate everything.
Yeah. So that's the one thing that I think when you mentioned earlier about don't use the UI at all. ARM templates are nice and they're great, and I love the benefit you get from them, and I use them all the time. But I do find sometimes knowing what to put in your JSON files can be quite tricky. There's all sorts of tools to help you with. I've not come across anything that is a real pleasure to use. So to be able to visualize those templates, how the dependencies between the things happen and all that kind of stuff. Some of the tools get close to it, but do you know of any other tools that help with authoring templates? It's quite easy to make mistakes with JSON, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So I always direct in three different ways. So one thing is to go to GitHub, just search for Azure Quick Start Templates if you're looking for inspiration. So Azure Quick Start Templates is a Microsoft employee-maintained repository where you will find, I would say, about 100 different configurations that you can use as a reference for building your templates. So they are leveled 100, 200, up to 400 for complexity. And you would find anything from Service Fabric that we discussed earlier to virtual machines to multi virtual machines with domain controllers configured, etc. So they can be quite extensive. The next one would be if you have access to Visual Studio, so the full-blown client. That client has a visual interface that can help you by wizard format to add resources and edit those templates, and it's quite helpful. If you don't have access to it, I recommend using Visual Studio Code.
Yeah, I did not know that. I actually have an ARM template that I've got to go make for one of the new technologies I'm getting ready to support, and I'm gonna have to go try that now. That's a great tip, Rasmus.
So just Visual Studio with the Azure SDK, and you're good to go.
Then you want to turn on the JSON outline. I think that's the window that you need, isn't it? So it gives you a hierarchical tree view of your resources.
Yes. So if you go, once you have the Azure SDK, you can go and create a new project called Azure Resource Group. And once you have a clean resource group, it's going to kick off the wizard and also load the JSON outline, which is very helpful.
Well, I am definitely going to go do that and build the source code control location for it at the same time.
And the last one, the last one I would direct people to, and it's not a perfect solution, but it is getting better every week, is using the Azure portal. So as I mentioned earlier, Azure portal or the UI is great for learning new things. But what you can actually do with these resource manager templates is log into the portal, build the solution that you would like, do it by hand. Right, and then you can export your configuration as a template. So you might have SQL there, you might have front end servers and DNS configuration, and just being able to export that as a template would give you all the context that you need to go and build your own template. I wouldn't say that you can copy it one to one, or at least you would need to clean up that export of a template, but you have all the right things there. You have all the syntaxes for the resource that you want to build. And that is very helpful, especially when you're starting up and working with this Azure Resource Manager for the first time.
Now, Rasmus, I was wondering about the governance side, right, of all this. Because one of the nice things with using the portal UI is that I suppose, there's an audit trail, who's logged in, there's a step-by-step, log of everything that you've done. And of course, I'm sure that the scripting version does the same thing, but does that come up as an issue, being able to, go after the fact and say, why do we have these 100 servers running? And, this is a script that did it, or this user did it on the UI. Like, how do you figure out all those things?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So so an added benefit of putting in the code is that you can also dictate the security model, right? So you can set permissions on these objects. But what you can do to address the specific problem that you're mentioning is again put in a release management model. So that can be different things.
Mm.
So what we see, what we apply at customers is a model where we use a tool to have these maybe gated deployments. So there must be some kind of sign-off before it deploys.
Right.
So there's two scenarios. One is we need some kind of approval step. So that could be one guy from operation that needs to approve a deployment before it happens. It could also be that we just need more control in general. So we have this segregation of duties thing, where in some large enterprises, developers are not allowed to deploy code to operations.
Right.
For many reasons. It might even be legal reasons. And here we can put in a release management tool. So again, this menu, we mentioned some of them before, like Jenkins, Visual Studio Team Services. And it's just taking the automation we built, as we talked about earlier, and putting it into a workflow. And it might be that you can automatically deploy to a test environment, a dev environment, maybe even a staging environment. But for that staging environment to go into production, a certain person or a set of persons need to sign off. And that might be a change review board if you're running ITIL. It might be a manager or a product owner. You decide. But these tools are available, and they are quite easy to implement if you did all the other steps, right?
Okay, that's good to know. Thanks a lot, Rasmus. Well, this is a very good list. I like the way you laid it out. Very well thought out, and glad that we have people thinking in this way. I think it's a big advantage. So, guys, any more questions for Rasmus or anything, Rasmus? Anything that you want to add? Any tips or tricks or anything like that you want to share with our listeners?
No, the only thing I want to share is get started. It's actually fun. The learning curve is steep, especially if you're not used to scripting, if you're not used to Azure. These things might look scary, but they're quite fun once you get started with it. And you're going to save a lot of time and make a lot of people happy by implementing these practices.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer PowerShell or ARM?
I would say ARM, but they go hand in hand, or arm in arm. Oh, that's bad.
Nice one.
Yeah, I like that.
Sorry about that. So, yeah, absolutely. If you want to see examples of how to build this, my I have a GitHub repo where it's at. It's called BrickOps. And you can just go, and I have some scripts for unit testing and examples of ARM templates, and everything is up there. You can go and check those out.
Awesome. We'll put all those links in the show notes. Send us those links, please. All right.
Thanks, Rasmus. I'm going to get going with some testing of the actual infrastructure build. I've just always relied on just the return code from the ARM template deployment before. So, it's given me something to think about.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks, Rasmus.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, and have a good evening.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye, folks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.